Joshua chapter 10. Now it came to pass when Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard how Joshua had taken Ai and had utterly destroyed it, as he had done to Jericho and its king, so he had done to Ai and its king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them. That they feared greatly because of Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all its men were mighty. Therefore Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, sent to Hoham, king of Hebron, Piram, king of Jarmuth, Japhia, king of Lachish, and Debir, king of Eglon, saying, "Come up to me and help me, that we may attack Gibeon. For it has made peace with Joshua and with the children of Israel." Therefore the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon, gathered together and went up, they and all their armies, and camped before Gibeon, and made war against it. Verse 6. And the men of Gibeon sent to Joshua at the camp at Gilgal, saying, "Do not forsake your servants. Come up to us quickly. Save us and help us, for all the kings of the Amorites who dwell in the mountains have gathered together against us." So Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not fear them, for I have delivered them into your hand. Not a man of them shall stand before you." Joshua, therefore, came upon them suddenly, having marched all night from Gilgal. So the Lord routed them before Israel, killed them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, chased them along the road that goes to Beth Horon, and struck them down as far as Azekah and Makkedah. And it happened, as they fled before Israel and were on the desert of Beth Horon, that the Lord cast down large hailstones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died from the hailstones than the children of Israel killed with the sword. Verse 12. Then Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, "Sun, stand still over Gibeon, and moon in the valley of Ajalon." So the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, till the people had revenge upon their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Jashar? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. And there has been no day like that before it or after it, that the Lord heeded the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. Then Joshua returned, and all Israel with him, to the camp at Gilgal. 16. But these five kings had fled and hidden themselves in a cave at Makkedah. And it was told Joshua, saying, "The five kings have been found hidden in the cave at Makkedah." So Joshua said, "Roll large stones against the mouth of the cave, and set men by it to guard them. And do not stay there yourselves, but pursue your enemies and attack their rear guard. Do not allow them to enter their cities, for the Lord your God has delivered them into your hand." And it happened, while Joshua and the children of Israel made an end of slaying them with a very great slaughter, still they had finished, that those who escaped entered fortified cities. And all the people returned to the camp, to Joshua at Makkedah, in peace. No one moved his tongue against any of the children of Israel. 22. Then Joshua said, "Open the mouth of the cave and bring out those five kings to me from the cave." And they did so, and brought those five kings to him from the cave: the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon. So it was, when they brought out those kings to Joshua, that Joshua called for all the men of Israel and said to the captains of the men of war who went with him, "Come near, put your feet on the necks of these kings." And they drew near and put their feet on their necks. Then Joshua said to them, "Do not be afraid, nor be dismayed. Be strong and of good courage, for thus the Lord will do to all your enemies against whom you fight." And afterward Joshua struck them and killed them and hanged them on five trees. And they were hanging on the trees until evening. So it was at the time of the going down of the sun that Joshua commanded, and they took them down from the trees, cast them into the cave where they had been hidden, and laid large stones against the cave's mouth, which remain until this very day. 28. On the day Joshua took Makkedah and struck it and its kings, and its king with the edge of the sword, he utterly destroyed them, all the people who were in it. He let none remain. He also did to the king of Makkedah as he had done to the king of Jericho. Then Joshua passed from Makkedah and all Israel with him to Libnah, and they fought against Libnah. And the Lord also delivered it and its king into the hand of Israel. He struck it and all the people who were in it with the edge of the sword. He let none remain in it, but did to its king as he had done to the king of Jericho. Then Joshua passed from Libnah and all Israel with him to Lachish, and they encamped against it and fought against it. And the Lord delivered Lachish into the hand of Israel, who took it on the second day and struck it and all the people who were in it with the edge of the sword, according to all that he had done to Libnah. Then Horam, king of Jizar, came up to help Lachish, and Joshua struck him and his people until he left him none remaining. From Lachish, Joshua passed to Eglon, and all Israel with him, and they encamped against it and fought against it. They took it on that day and struck it with the edge of the sword. All the people who were in it, he utterly destroyed that day, according to all that he had done to Lachish. So Joshua went up from Eglon and all Israel with him to Hebron, and they fought against it. And they took it and struck it with the edge of the sword, its king, all its cities, and all the people who were in it. He left none remaining, according to all that he had done to Eglon, but utterly destroyed it and all the people who were in it. Then Joshua returned, and all Israel with him to Debir, and they fought against it. And he took it and its king and all its cities. They struck them with the edge of the sword and utterly destroyed all the people who were in it. He left none remaining, as he had done to Hebron. So he did to Debir and its king, and he had done also to Libnah and its king. So Joshua conquered all the land, the mountain country and the south, and the lowland and the wilderness slopes, and all their kings. He left none remaining, but utterly destroyed all that breathed, as the Lord God of Israel had commanded. And Joshua conquered them from Kadesh Barnea as far as Gaza, and all the country of Goshen, even as far as Gibeon. All these kings and their land Joshua took at one time, because the Lord God of Israel fought for Israel. Then Joshua returned, and all Israel with him, to the camp at Gilgal.
Thank you, David. Appreciate him reading that for us, Joshua chapter 10. Before we begin, does anybody have any comments or questions they'd like to raise? Yes, Jeff.
I was interested in verse 14, talking about that day, and it mentions that there's never been a day like it before or since, a day when the Lord listened to a man. Just thought that was interesting, because there must be more to it than just listen to a man, because obviously he's listened to a lot of men up to that point in time, and done lots of miraculous things because of it.
Didn't he also stop the sun one day for another man?
He sort of. He moved the sun.
Oh.
One day for another man. Yes, it was much later on. Yes, but it's not quite like this scenario, which, because Joshua requested it, which is the hint to listen to a man, it happened. The other scenario, which it was moved, took a prophet to go to God and say, all right, in order to prove this king that he's not going to die today, please move the sun. So he moved the sun for him, which is, granted, these are miracles by all accounts. Any other comments or questions? It's a good point that you did, boy, just listen to a man, because in this particular story, it does point out that, it says that quite plainly, Joshua did it not because he needed to. He didn't need to have the sun stop. He requested it, and then God said, even though you don't need it, I'm going to grant it, which is how they have interpreted listen to a man, because it's such a unique scenario. All the other scenarios, there was a purpose behind God listening to men. They'll please do this, or like Elijah. God send these fire down to burn up the altar. It was for benefit of everybody around that could see, oh, there really is a God of Israel. It actually had practical value to it. This was a little bit different in Joshua's case, because he didn't need the sun to stop, which we'll go deeper into that as the hour progresses. Any other comments?
Don't mess around with Joshua.
Yeah. Don't mess around with Joshua.
I just got upon God, you're hot that day.
Yeah.
So maybe it did serve a practical purpose.
In that scenario, what he's pointing out, yes, which is what we're going to do earlier in the verse, it points out they did all the eyes of Israel. It wasn't just, all right, yes, so Israel marched all night long, made it to this battleground and won. In order to continuously reaffirm that it wasn't Israel fighting, per se, all by themselves, that God was still fighting for them. In that case, yes, you could say, yeah, it was a value to it. But as far as the battle was concerned, it wasn't technically needed. They had routed the enemy pretty much, essentially, before noon. Right, well, we'll get into the actual time frame. Joshua shows up here about 9 o'clock in the morning, by the way, when he says this statement. So he routes the enemy very early on. But, so whether it needed a full day or an extra 24 hours, it's up for debate. It's not a big deal. It's beyond the point. I'll get into the time frame, how I know it's by 9 o'clock in the morning later. Any other comments or questions? Okay, then we'll go ahead and begin then. I'm actually getting a little bit better. I have part of my notes typed up. I'm progressing. Okay. As I mentioned 2 weeks ago, unlike the scenario with Ai and Jericho, when Joshua and all people came up and attacked the cities were destroyed. Burned to the ground, nothing there. Well, in Deuteronomy, it points out that God was going to grant Israel, Deuteronomy chapter 6, those of you who are curious where it's at, verses 10 to 11, that God said, you're going to inherit cities. You're going to inherit property, vines. You're going to inherit fields fully planted that you were not the planters. You were not the builders. You're going to inherit them complete. Well, in the case of Ai and Jericho, those areas were wiped out. There's nothing to inherit. Well, how do you get around this scenario? How do you get them to inherit a city without destroying the city in the process? Simple. Bring all the army out into the field. And then the city is left virtually vacant, or partially vacant. There are women and children, and there are a few guards left, but there's not a significant amount. You don't have to burn the whole city down. You can just take them out rather quickly. Hence, it describes that he actually did so to these particular five kings. So, in the scenario with Gibeon, last time we talked about this, about the deceiving and lying in order to strike a covenant, it actually turned out a benefit to Joshua and all the people, because then the other kings were roused up to attack Gibeon. talk about a servant. They served quite well. They served as a catalyst that allowed all these kings and all their various military men to come out of their cities to attack them in the open field. Much easier to work with. So I want to point that out, that this process of pulling kings and cities and emptying them in battle, to its open battlefield, happens a couple of times now. This is just the one scenario. These are just five cities. It actually happens quite a few more times up in the northern section of Israel, that the kings and the men of valor evacuate to come attack, leaving their cities vulnerable. Too easy to take, so the cities can then be inherited, fulfilling the prophecy that God gave. You will inherit not just the physical land, but you will inherit fields, you will inherit cities, you will inherit houses. Hence, that's how they got their inheritance.
I mean, isn't that quite unusual? Because the whole reason why they built fortified cities was so that you don't end up having to fight from such a vulnerable position.
Exactly. That's the precise reason why you have fortified cities, and so they wouldn't have to do this. So what, now we mentioned this a few weeks ago, what would motivate all these kings to do this? And this is a scenario of five kings. There's actually more kings compiled together in the northern section. There's even more than just five. But right now we're dealing with the five individuals this chapter. What would make them want to do this? Yes, Tammy.
Maybe one reason that they were so upset by being betrayed by the Gibeonites, because they play two sides against the middle, so to speak, that they weren't thinking rationally. They didn't think this through too well.
That is a great point. Now, and that would work for these five kings, which we talked about. Now, in the northern kingdom, the opposite happens. They don't go up against a king or a city. They go against Israel themselves and lose horribly. So they have the same, or they're not the same, they may have a different rationalization for their evacuating of their towns up in the northern section, and that may be the precise reason these five kings did it. We talked about earlier, though, 2 weeks ago, that we mentioned that, all right, there were different methodologies by the kings of Canaan that they employed to try to stop the Israelites. The first one was complete defense, Jericho. Get inside your walls, nice and fortified, hunker down, you'll be okay. You'll wait them out. They tried, the city was wiped out. And the second method of defense was Ai, the city of Ai. And their method was, forget trying to defend yourself, go on the offense. They got all their men out and they attacked. Well, that method didn't work. Now, mind you, all the other towns and cities are watching these events. I mean, they can see, oh, look, Jericho crushed down the ground. Wow, their fortification wasn't really that value to them. I mean, it was a great fortification, but it didn't work. And then look at Ai. Well, he went on the offense. Crud, that didn't work either. Their offense, maybe it was because it was just too small. Hence the five kings. Well, if we were bigger, we might do a better chance, which the kings of the north did that. They went, well, we'll get a large group together. But the five kings said, all right, defenses don't necessarily work by themselves, and a single little town offense doesn't necessarily work by itself. Let's start going another employ. Get the next grab, which is a larger group brought together. Now, granted, yes, they went against Gibeon, which was an easy target, which we'll get into that in a minute, because Gibeon, the people of Gibeon, said something which raises a red flag, because they knew that they were caught between a rock and a hard place at this point, not just against the five kings, but also Israel's choice in helping them. Israel didn't have to help them. We'll get to that in a minute. So they went against Gibeon, thinking that you could conquer one town quickly, we all get together, we'll show a fortified front, type of philosophy, teach a lesson, exactly. Didn't work. There's also another strategy, which was employed by Makeda, which is, don't defend yourself, don't go on the offense. Just pretend nothing happens. Let life go around you, and if you're out of the fray and you keep shut, they'll leave you alone. Well, that didn't work either. They said, oh, as Joshua was going by, essentially, oh, hello, yes, you didn't fight us, okay, now you're gone too. That strategy didn't work. So we have a total of four different strategies being applied. None of them were successful in stopping the Israelites and Joshua from conquering the land. Why? It's prophecy that God was fighting for them. Now, if you employed these strategies in a normal battlefield, they probably would be very successful. They didn't work here because God was on their side. Yes, Bill.
If Because you always said, wipe them all out, that's enough. But why did they have to take out the women and children too?
Going back to what the warning which was happened to Moab, or actually children of Israel regarding Moab and various other groups of people on the other side of the Jordan, God pointed out, Moses pointed out directly, if you go into a territory or a land and you take over its occupants or take over the area and you allow the women and children to live or survive, they will intermarry as their descendants will intermarry with your children, thus turning your heart away from God and toward their gods, which is precisely what Israel wound up doing. They didn't wipe out everybody. Now, they were supposed to. More often than not, they were unsuccessful in doing so. They wiped out a small portion, or they left a small town alone because it was too big or too hard. That kind of thing happens, and we'll get through that as we go through the various books of Judges, or chapters of Judges. So the reason to give rid of the women and children is to avoid the turning of the heart. Corruption. That's the purpose. Now, keep in mind, we think of, oh, death, how hard and gross and very mean to do to poor women and children. Well, yes, but we're looking at from mankind's perspective. Look at it from God's perspective. Death, it's a temporary thing. Don't worry about it. We'll fix it later. It's a different philosophy when you're looking at death of something in God's eyes versus something in man's eyes. We look at it being a tragic thing. He looks at it being a temporary body. You're going to die anyway. It's just a matter of we happen to accelerate it a few of your years than what you had originally intended. It's no big deal. So try not to think of it quite in that manner as far as a humanistic perspective of it. You're looking at it from God's eyes. He's the one who dictated that this was going to happen. Now, let's get into verse 6. The Gibeonites... I think this is funny to me, because I look at it comically, but not everybody necessarily would say that. Verse 6 says, the men of Gibeon sent to Joshua to the camp, to Gilgal, saying, do not loosen your hands from your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us or help us, for all the Amorite kings who dwell in the mountains have gathered against us. I think it's funny they said, save us or help us. See, the covenant deal that Israelite leaders struck with Gibeon was that, yeah, we will go to battle with you if you are battling, and you'll go to battle with us if we are battling, which never actually happened. Gibeon never, not for many generations did that actually occur. But the primary thing is, we will not fight one another. Israel will not destroy Gibeon. I mean, essentially, that's the major point of the covenant. It doesn't say someone else is not allowed to destroy Gibeon. The covenant didn't say that. So Gibeon, I believe, knew that wasn't part of the deal. That they could come up and assist, quote, help, but still allow Gibeonites to be obliterated. They didn't break the covenant. They would have helped, but they didn't attack Gibeon. Gibeonites gone, their problem solved. Pretty simple. Gibeonites, I think, knew that. Hence, they said, please save us, or at least help us. They happened to invoke, however, the servant. As a servant, this is a matter of an honor issue, biblically speaking, not we think today, well, you have a servant, you pay him, and your wages or your issue with each other, your deal with each other is taken care of. In this case, a servant is under your protection. So using that terminology, I believe it invoked a more emotional response from the leadership of Israel, hence to not only go into help, I think their intention was to actually annihilate the coming kings. But I think it's fascinating that Gibeon pointed out, you may not want to save us, but at least help us, because they knew it's a possibility they could say, well, we'll let the kings wipe you out because you deceived us anyway. We had nothing to lose. But fortunately for the honor of Israel, they went ahead and followed through with Gibeon's request. I just find that funny. I think it comical that Gibeon probably knew the difference. They could have said, yeah, we'll help you. We'll send a couple of guys to watch or whatever, give you some pointers, but still let you get wiped out, which five kings on one town could have easily done so.
We'll send advisors.
Yeah, we'll send advisors. That's help, right? That's good enough. I just find it funny because I find that anyway. I'm done with that. Okay. Yeah, so they invoked the point of servants, so which now is a responsibility associated with servants. Okay, verse 7. It says, Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty warriors. Hashem said to Joshua, do not fear them, for I have delivered them into your hand. Not a man of them shall stand against you. So Joshua basically said, all right, God, am I supposed to go save Gideon? Or Gibeon. Gideon's another person. If I'm supposed to go save this town, essentially, should I go do this? Don't worry about it. Go, and all the kings you're going to go against are going to fall before you. It's a good, solid prophecy. This is in stark contrast to the chapter before, where Joshua did not inquire of God whether I should go do this. For Gibeon, he did not ask. Hence, he got in trouble. Well, this time, he asked. He wanted to make sure that mistake was not repeated again, whether or not Gibeon was supposed to be saved or not. So this was taking care of Joshua's problem from the previous chapter. So they traveled all night from Gilgal. Verse 9 points out, Joshua came upon them suddenly. He had descended from Gilgal all night. Now, I'm going to draw my little map. For those of you who are listening to this and can't see, I'm just drawing the cities that were involved in this particular chapter and where they're located at relative to the Dead Sea in Israel. So Gilgal is here, northern tip of the Dead Sea on the west side of the Jordan. And then we're going to travel. Gibeon is approximately 10 to 12 miles as a bird flies. Now, granted, this is mountainous territory, so it's not like an easy 10, 12 mile trek. But they're 10 to 12 miles further west. I'm going 10 to 12 because there's like a little map legend that gives you the little bars. It's kind of hard to measure using that. So Gibeon, I spelt that right. Well, it doesn't matter. Travel from Gilgal to Gibeon. However method they need to get there. They're obviously going through over mountainous terrain. Gibeon is like 2,000 feet above sea level. Gilgal is like 100 feet above sea level. So they're trekking upward most of this route. The other kings which are involved, Jerusalem's the closest to Gibeon, by the way. They're about 5-6 miles away, short distance. They're the ones, of course, as you know, at the beginning of the chapter, were the ones who were saying, hey, everybody else come help us, it's Gibeon. Why Gibeon's so close? Jerusalem feels the pressure a lot more than some of the other kings who are another 10, 15, 20 miles further south. But Jerusalem kind of encourages them, and they all say, okay, we'll go together. So Jerusalem's closest. Hebron is way down here. And we have Jarmuth and Eglon and Lachish. So the distance between it, Lachish, Eglon, and whatnot, they're traveling 30 to 40 miles to get, depending on which sits on your home, to get to this battlefield. Armies don't travel quickly. All right, we all know that. It takes a long time. Not to mention you're going to travel a long distance and then immediately fight. So this gathering of this army probably took a few days or weeks, most likely weeks more accurately, to get enough manpower up there and blah, blah, blah that goes out. Yeah, spies go around. So it probably took a few weeks to get to Gibeon to go to battle. Joshua gets there in approximately 6 hours. His whole army. Now, he gets there in about roughly 6 hours. It's an approximation because it's a nighttime time slot. We know this is approximately May, as far as time of year. So they have so many hours to make this happen. They could have traveled from sunset the following day. No one really knows. So it may have taken longer than 6 hours, but the point is they got there basically when the sun was rising, which we're going to approach later on as to how I know it was 9 o'clock when he spoke to the sun. That's evidence of other nations or the cultures to record the time of day it was when the sun stopped moving. They said, hey, wait a minute, this is such and such. What happened? And they know what time it was for their time because some of them use independent methods for telling time other than sundials. Because if you use sundials, well, they're of no value. Sun doesn't move, dial doesn't move. Well, if you have other methods of telling time, then you can record, hey, this is how long this took before the sun moved again. So other cults recorded time, and you can do maps of the earth and projected angles of sun and figure out its approximate with about 9 o'clock, it would take half an hour. So they travel Gilgal to Gibeon all night long. After they get there, what do they do? Immediately go to battle. Again, very unusual for any army to do. Travel a long distance, large numbers, being exhausted normally. Most armies, especially traveling all night long, you obviously did not sleep from the day before, so this is probably up in your 24-hour mark. People start getting a little loopy then. Not to mention, it's going to be a very long, extended day, so you couldn't, plus 48-ish, 50, 60 hours here of no sleep, you're getting really loopy at the end of that. So, but yet these guys are able to go to battle and win. So they travel all night. All these kings probably took a couple weeks to get there. They had a minor advantage. Okay. The sun standing still. Yeah, the internet's an amazing thing. It gets you so much information about stories and issues regarding this particular day. There is a lot of garbage floating around there, too. So you have to be careful as what you're looking at. But Joshua requests God in the eyes of all of Israel. Sun stands still over Gibeon. Now, sun, obviously, we know does not stand directly above Gibeon. It's just a metaphorical speak, because actually it's further south than that. The sun doesn't reach that far north, as far as directly vertically above it. And it says the moon in, Ajalon or Ayalon, however you want to pronounce it. It's in a valley. Now, Ayalon, by the way, for time of day, Gibeon is here, as I pointed out earlier. Ayalon, the city, is roughly 10 miles, 15 miles or so further west, which is happening where the valley is too. There's a small mountain range here, the valley of drawing a basic what the valley would look like pointing towards the sea. If sun's above Gibeon and you can see the moon in Ayalon, however you pronounce it, further west, what time of day is this?
Near sunset.
No, close to sunrise. If sun's closer to me and then the moon is further west and I can see it from my naked eye, notice when you're like going to work in the morning and the sun is rising, let's say, where, and you see the moon, where is it? Well, you can only see it certain times of day. As the sun continues to rise, you can no longer see the moon anymore. It's too bright. Well, you can see the moon and the sun at the same time if the moon is on the west side of the sun in the morning. Midday, you can't see the moon anymore. All right, getting a picture? We're going to prove time later. But it gives you an idea that this is some time prior to noonish. Because by noon, you really can't see the moon how hard you try. It's too bright outside. Well, there are certain times of day you can do it, but it's pretty rare. And these are short distances away from each other, 10 miles or so, roughly. So it's got a particular angle that you can see from Gibeon to Ashkelon. Pronounced the name wrong. I find it interesting. I want to point out to you that you will find many scholars and commentaries trying to explain how this can happen. I'll tell you, initially, don't even bother. It's a miracle. All right, it is a miracle. Bottom line, you can't say, well, people say, oh, well, he stopped the earth from spinning. Well, yeah, if you try to stop an ocean from spinning 1,000 miles an hour, good luck. You just wiped out the whole continent of everything on planet Earth, because that's about the speed at which the equator rotates, about 1,000 miles an hour, approximately the speed of a jet fighter at top speed. So you're not going to make those oceans stop instantaneously if you tried to stop the earth from spinning. Note, they have tried to argue scientists, well, if you put a plate, a saucer of water in a jet, and you start flying 1,000 miles an hour, how do you stop the jet without the saucer spilling? Well, they point, if you slow the jet down at this rate, you can stop it in 35 minutes and the water won't spill. Ah, thus, God must have stopped the earth in 35 minutes. There's a difference between a saucer and an ocean, okay? Oceans, when you have an earthquake, little teeny bit of far distance away, what does it do? Massive tidal waves. It takes more than 35 minutes for that tidal wave to cross from one end of the ocean to the other, but yet it's still there. All right, it can still travel large distances for teeny amounts of movement. So the whole theory doesn't work. So there are a lot of theories, though, because I found them fascinating while I was reading them this morning. Like, oh, holy cow. So I'll read some of the, I'm going to rattle off a few of these to you. I'm not going to go through all of them because they're kind of pointless.
They're entertaining, right?
What was that? They are entertaining, yes. Refraction theory. That God didn't actually stop the sun, or the earth from spinning. He just bent the light and continued to make it bend and bend and bend until it finally had reached the earth. Well, okay, now we're dealing with approximately a 24-hour time. So God bent the earth in a 360-degree angle over that time slot, else he has to turn it off and then turn it back on again in order to recorrect the light bending. Besides that, that does not jive with what the scripture says. It says he stopped the earth and stopped the moon. All right. Granted, you can say, well, it's perspective of man. Don't even go there. If God's bending the light to make this happen, he didn't stop anything. Didn't listen to a man then, did he?
Yeah, well, plus, you know, the light would start getting redder and redder.
Exactly. Because you're bending it in, and you're doing loops, and crazy stuff is happening with this light. Because he's not just stopping the sun, he's stopping the moon also. So he's bending two different things, and they travel in opposite directions. If you ever noticed that, I'm sure many of you have, the moon does set, by the way, in the east, not the west. It travels that direction. So he's bending one way and looping the other one the other direction, and they're still reflecting off of each other, mind you. So you got a lot of little lights flying around all the place. And they're obviously, they look like morning, or roughly midday, what you want to argue, as that day progresses the whole time. There is no, yeah, red colors, there's no funny looking colors as it's traveling around the earth. So the refraction theory was a way of people trying to explain how God did this without stopping the earth. They have Jewish commentators who have argued, this was kind of funny to me, that, well, it was because the day was so productive that they got the amount of 2 days' work done in one. Thus, it was 2 days. That's very common in modern Judaism, believe it or not. They actually, most of them, not all, most of them believe that it's just because they did so much that day. They wiped out the five kings. They took out Makeda. They took out all these other little towns down below. They traveled probably somewhere around 50, 60 miles in a day. That's a lot to do in a day. That must be it. It's just it seemed like 2 days. The concept of a human believing it just feels like it's so, because they're so tired, they haven't slept for so long, it might as well have been a month. You know, that kind of philosophy. The other prevalence that it didn't happen in May, it happened in June. Hence the longest day of the year, June 20-something. That must have been what it is. It was 15 hours plus long, so it was as if it was 2 days for winter time, because practically, not double, but it's long winter. Yes, Jeff.
I have lived in a place where the sun does not go down for
yes.
Yes. And it certainly does move, because you can sit there and watch it going around
yep.
the sky.
It still moves.
Right above the horizon.
Yep.
It still moves.
It still moves. It's funny. It's comical. You can't say it froze still and say, well, it's just because it was a long day. No. It says it stopped moving. Then that's what it did. So that was a comical. Another one is God changed the rotational axis of the earth to what was right above Gibeon. Hence, the sun was there, and then the earth stopped rotating on the north and south pole, and now it switched to between the Canaanites, so it was rotating there. Hence, the sun looks like it's not moving. Major problem, it said the moon stayed in one particular valley. If you change the axis here, guess what? The moon starts circling the sun. You'd think they would have noticed that, not to mention all the other physics that would go into that to make that happen, which would be beyond words.
Basically, make Gibeon the north pole?
Yeah, essentially, make Gibeon the north pole to make the sun stand still. It's a little, it's silly. But they were funny to read, because I thought they were comical. There were a few other two theories that I'm not going to go into all of them. They start getting into computers, models, and kind of garbage that try to make this happen naturally or somehow explaining how this could have occurred. The point is, God made a miracle happen. Bottom line. Take the word as it says, made a miracle happen. Don't try to force a physics explanation into the miracle. It's a waste of time. There's also the fiction people that believe, well, it just never happened. It was just a story people made up. It never really occurred. Let's see, I make sure I covered all the basics. Yeah, that's pretty much it. There's also an Eclipse issue, too. Go ahead.
Well, you had mentioned the standpoint that it's been noted in other cultures.
Yes, that's what I want to cover. I was about to go into. One before I get there, there is one other theory that said it was an eclipse. Hence, the sun and the moon were eclipsed. See, that because the sun rose in the morning, it sets because of the eclipse, and it rises again after the eclipse, and then sets in the sunset. It's crazy. Don't worry about it. They ignore the fact that, you know, Hebrew language has a word for eclipse. If they said it was an eclipse, it would have been an eclipse. The point is, it wasn't an eclipse. Another said, well, it's because the sun went under a cloud. Well, okay, they would have said it was a cloudy day, not that the sun stood there still for 2 hours. Okay.
Joshua somehow.
Exactly. Yeah, it's crazy. Now, other issues. How do we know this actually happened? What evidence would you find? You can't go back and count it. And no is a relative term. What evidence would we have that would indicate something like this occurred? Because if I go to every culture on planet Earth and they all say the same thing, oh, well, the sun stood still. Throughout the whole world, the sun stood still. Well, then that would imply that a central location, it happened, and then the rest of the world, that central location is just word spread out. Hold on. The opposite would be a case for if I said the moon stood still, it was nighttime. Well, because it would happen in one location, just like the theory of the Noah's flood issue. Well, every culture has a story of Noah's flood. Well, yes, every culture has the same or very similar story because it happened and the theory in the story went out. Hence, it was one location, one event. If the culture for the sun standing still has it, well, if that same scenario happened with the sun in Joshua's time, then everybody would have the same story. However, if Joshua's area had the story of the sun, what does the other side of the earth have?
Darkness.
Story of the longest night. Different stories. Those people that's longest night don't have a story of the longest day. They have a story of the longest night. Not only that, there are actually some sections that have the story of the longest sunset.
Yeah.
They do not have a story in their culture of day or night, but a sunset.
Oh, I'd go for that one.
That'd be fascinating. and they had these stories scattered through the world of this happening. Now, they have different times. Some say, well, the sun was up for 10 days in Chinese culture. The sun was high noon practically for 10 days. Right, is this problem with Chinese culture at the time use sundials? How long is a day if you're using a sundial? Who knows? The Egyptian culture, however, is your key. You see, in the Egyptian culture, they didn't use sundials.
Water clock?
They used water clocks. A lot more effective in when it comes to telling time independent of the sun. So what did they find out? Erase my little board here, because I'm not going to go through all of their conquerings. It would take a lot longer than the time frame that I've got. So Egypt's water clocks. Note that Israel here on this side. You have the Sinai Peninsula and Egypt's way over here. All right. Egypt has a story of the longest sunrise. But they actually have a lot of detail in their story as far as what they observed. Quite fascinating. A gentleman many, many years ago recorded this information. The Egyptian account, I'm going to read part of this to you. Pronounce their god's name, I don't remember. Hephaistos? Anyway, it's Greek translation of their name, of the god's name. Grant protection to your worshippers, prevent the words of these foreign travelers. They're referring to Israelite, by the way. This is a little bit into the chapter. That what they've got here is that the enemies sacrifice the images be destroyed, their temples of those, let's see. Oh, stop, okay. To Ramses who expelled these foreign travelers, referring to Egypt expelling in through the Red Sea, and gave them help where they needed to cast them into the sea, they made the moon stop in a small angle at the edge of the horizon. In a small angle on the edge of the horizon, the sun itself, which had just risen at the spot where the moon was going to, instead of crossing the sky, stayed where it was. Whilst the moon, following a narrow path, reduced its speed and climbed slowly, the sun stopped. And its intensity of light was reduced to the brightness at daybreak.
The waves formed a wall of water against the boats that were on the harbor of the Nile. And those who had left it, those fishermen, had ventured into the deck to watch the waters wash, watch the waves, sorry, were washed into the sea. The fishermen were taken out and brought into the sea. The tide, which had risen, overflowed into the plains where the herds were grazing. The cattle drowned, represented half the herds of Lower Egypt. The remains of the abandoned boats were broken against the sides of the canals, were piled up in places. Their anchors, which should have protected them, had been ground into them. The anchors had gone into the canals. Quite out of control, the sea had penetrated deep into the countryside. The expanding waters reached the fortified walls constructed by Ramses, the celestial ancestral chief. The sea swept around both sides of the region behind sterilizing the gardens as it went and causing the openings of the Egyptian dikes. A great country had been turned into a wilderness and brought into poverty. All crops that had been planted had been destroyed, and heaps of plant shoots lay scattered on the ground. That's a very detailed description of Egyptian. Now, this comes from Gombetti. I think that's his name. Make sure I got it right. Oh, other page. Joshua's longer days, vision of getting into it. Hey, I just lost my previous page. It's heavy when you copy things back to back on the same sheet of paper. Oh, there it is. Todden is actually who recorded part of this. He recorded it based off of Dimbley's account of the Egyptian hieroglyphics he was reading. Yes, Tammy.
I find it fascinating that the Egyptians, mostly what they're recording is the effect of the tides.
Exactly.
So if you stop the moon, it affects the tidal
exactly.
system.
Now, this is interesting, though. They noted that the moon didn't actually stop. Moon kept going. The sun is what they recorded to stop. You read what we looked what I was reading. So the sun stopped and the moon was traveling to where the sun was at.
You have a double tide there.
Yeah, exactly. You've got the tides are still being pulled with the moon as they normally would. Now, but doesn't this conflict with what Joshua said? No, actually it doesn't.
Well, they were pretty far inland. So.
Well, that's true. But Joshua pointed out, he said, hey, the sun's still and the moon in the valley of Ajalon. It doesn't mean that he did not say the moon must not move while it's in the valley of Ajalon, just that it remains in the valley. The valley's a large space. He didn't tell the moon to stop. Bottom line, Joshua's words actually told the sun to stop and the moon to stay in one valley. It can still travel. The moon travels slowly, by the way. It's not a very quick speed. But the Egyptians recorded it was a low angle, very low angle. What is as daybreak? What time of in May? What time of the morning is it in Egypt? If it's at daybreak in May, well, approximately 8 o'clock, roughly at 8:30, somewhere in that time slot as far as daybreak, as far as it's rising up. They have water clocks, by the way. Egyptians actually recorded approximately 24 hours past, not exact 24. It was just shy of that, but approximately 4 hours past on their water clocks before the sun started to move again. This is interesting. So the time slot when they're saying, Egypt is saying, hey, it's dawn, and it's not moving, what time of day is it in Israel? Or actually Gibeon territory.
Like an hour later, maybe two.
Roughly an hour later, maybe two. 8 to 9 o'clock. Well, actually, because technically that time of year, Egypt, about 7:30. It's about 8:30 to 9:30, about the time slot. Hence, Joshua talked and told God, approximately 10 o'clock, give or take half an hour, stop the moon. Or sorry, 9 o'clock in the morning, stop the sun, keep the moon in the valley. Hence, it was morning time, based on Egyptian account. Now, the Egyptian account is just one account. They have a story, I mentioned earlier, the Fiji Islands, the longest sunset, Egyptian longest sunrise. Opposite of the earth of Egypt is Fiji. Longest sunset. They record it lasting approximately 20 hours of a sunset. You can't use the Chinese example because they use sundials. They don't know how long it lasted. They said that everyone was afraid and upset because the crops were dying. Continuous sun being poured on the whole time. It would do that. Well, look, what happened in North America? The middle of the night in North America. So what were the Indians recording down? Well, there are multiple different recordings of different issues regarding longer nighttime.
Most of them were symbolic. Oh, well, then the gods during creation held the long night. We had to kill some gods to make the long night go away. Most of them were in that context. And they said it lasted for years. Long nights lasted for years. Well, okay. That may be true in some Indian cultures as far as what they wrote down. Now, I could rattle off a few of them, but I'm not going to. The Awebians and the Omayans and the Bunji and the Wanolt and the whatever else. Anyway. There were, however, one culture, the Mayan culture, who actually recorded time much more accurate than the other year-on-end night times. The Mayan culture recorded it at approximately 20 hours of solid night. And they said the people were upset. They would console one another and talk, but they were unable to be at rest until they finally saw the sun rise. They actually record that in their writings. The people were mad. They thought, we have killed the sun god. Something happened to us because the land has sinned, especially in Peru, which they were very big on this at the time.
And here, it would be cold, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is in springtime.
Yeah.
So it's not really a freezing point in time. But you would note that, yeah, there's the sun's not up. Yeah, you start worrying about it. So my point is, and there are other continuing points out in Central, South America. I won't go through all of them. My time's pretty much gone. I'm well past it, actually. But, draw a little map up here. I can give you this map if those of you who are interested in looking at it. By the way, I got most of my research from, geocentricity.com. It's an astronomy / biblical account of astronomy to figure out where the Bible and astronomy coincide or disagree. Now, I'm condensing it down. He made a much more detailed description of every theory you could have ever heard of and disproved each and every single one of them. Biblically disproved it. And the bottom line his was, hey, it was a miracle and a story. He's right. It was a miracle and a story. So, those of you who wish that you may or may not disagree with him, but it doesn't really matter. This is where most of my information came from. So, he recorded events. I'm going to quick sketch. Forgive my terrible penmanship. North America.
I like it.
Africa. China's over here. Russia up there. And Europe and Middle East and Australia. Okay, so what we have. Stories of longest nighttime. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 in the Americas. Different areas. We have up in Washington, a few in California, Navajo area, one in Canada, what state that is there, a couple in New York. We have a couple in Mexico, one in South America. Longest nights in North America. Some of them claimed, I mentioned earlier, years of the long night.
Probably seemed like years.
It may seem like years, I'm sure. The Mayans recorded it was about 20 hours. Note, the Mayans gave the date. They said it was a particular king. I don't think I have his name written down. Anyway.
A particular what?
Particular king, the Mayan kings. Oh, so many numbers here. I can't see his name out of hand. It's in this paper somewhere. Approximately our equivalent to 1400 BC. Approximately. Now, their dates are a little fuzzy compared to exact conversion, but what time did Joshua, what year roughly did Joshua enter the land? Approximately 1450 to 1440 BC. So we have a fairly close time record as far as when this occurred. Mayans are the only ones in this culture in North America that actually recorded time and dates of kings and noted when one king came over and they recorded accurately, much similar to the Egyptian style of recording. We have one other record of the longest night, which is in West Africa. I don't recall what country that is. It doesn't really matter. Fiji Islands, longest sunset, way down here, doing a half dark, half light. The Fiji people believed if you, still today actually, if you need to extend the sun from setting at the sunset, don't tie weeds together on this one particular hillside and the sun will not set. Hence their methodology for making the sun set, they tied weeds together thinking that's what did it. It's just comical. Longest day, other than Joshua's story, well, we'll include that one too. We have one in approximately Italy,
obviously Egypt, which we already talked about, the longest day break. We have Joshua's story, we have an Indian story, and we have China's story. Maybe I should do little circles. Because it actually sounds... So we have all these different cultures who are pointing out longest day, longest night. We've looked at a little map as far as when sun shines and when sun doesn't shine, it matches precisely to that pattern. Now, none of these cultures have longest night times. None of these cultures have longest day in their history. Hence, my point is, multiple cultures, multiple, quote, witnesses, I quote, I want to use that term important, it's an important term, that Joshua's story isn't all by itself.
Right.
The miracle was actually recorded in many cultures at the same time. It said something funny is happening here.
Yeah.
Don't try to explain it. Don't waste your time explaining it. The point is, a miracle happened. Yes, Jeff.
Well, especially when you consider that how many of those cultures you just mentioned had sun or moon as a deity.
Oh,
that
yeah.
That must have been quite frightening.
Yes. They had the Aztecs, I believe, is the one who decided to kill all their gods. To think, well, if they kill our gods, then our gods will become the god of the sun and then pull it across. Well, I'm not going to go into there. But yes, it would have been quite frightening. Any other points? Well, I wanted to go a little further into some of the conquests, but I'm out of time. Let's see. Oh, one other point. I got to make this important because it'll be confusing in a couple of chapters from now. Joshua's men took over a city. They did not occupy it. As it points out quite clearly in Scripture, they all returned to Gilgal. The five cities that were talked about, well, I erased them. Hebron, Jarmuth, Eglon, they didn't actually take Jerusalem this time. Those cities that they took out, wiped out the villages, wiped out what was there as far as men, human beings. They all left, leaving those villages and cities to be reoccupied by still more pagans later. I'm going to bring that up because in a couple of chapters from now, Caleb and Othniel has to retake some of these towns again. Now, granted, they're much easier to retake because there weren't that many people, but there were enough that they had to mention, hey, and so-and-so had to go in and kill off these few individuals of some of the same towns Joshua already took out. It's because Joshua, everybody went back. Why? Why'd they go back? Because the territory was not to be divided quite yet. No one could inherit land until it was deeded for their tribe or territory to inherit it. So just because your whole team, the whole nation of Israel came and took something out, no one knew who that would belong to. They had theory, pretty good idea, but no one knew for sure. You can't stay there. You go back home to Gilgal. I want to make that point clear to not confuse anyone that think, well, Joshua didn't actually do this because Caleb and Othniel took out these two towns. I don't understand. Well, this is what had happened. Any other questions or comments? I'm late, but I apologize. It was fun.